Lou Manfredini here. Do you have cracked or sunken concrete areas around your home? Call PermaSeal for a free estimate. Don't replace it, raise it. Call 800-421-7325 or visit permaseal.net.
Hi, I'm Shadow Stevens. On this episode of Nostalgia Stories, WGN sister station Antenna TV spoke with Mike Score of A Flock of Seagulls. Listen as we chat with Mike about the band and their hit single, Iran. What sparked your interest in music?
Well, I used to be a paper boy when I was a little kid, so I used to have a little transistor radio that I, you know, just kept blaring all the time. So I ended up being a kind of 10-year-old music critic to myself, you know? And that, from that, I think that's what really sparked it. And then the Beatles being from Liverpool as well, you know, when I was about, I guess about 14, when the Beatles were really getting big and, you know, everybody was talking about them. So it was kind of like, what is this? What are the Beatles? Oh, they're a group. Great, you know. But I never got to see them. But it got my interest. They were on the news and stuff in England. So it was big stuff, you know, and that and the Stones and then the whole explosion of like the 60s stuff, you know, as a kid it all comes flying in at you. And I think after that, when the late 70s with bands like Ultravox, they got synthesizers came out, and that's really what caught me, was the sounds of synths. Suddenly there was atmosphere, you know. Before that, there were a lot of groups were just basically twangy guitars and, you know, there's a bit of Beach Boys and stuff. And when they did Good Vibrations, you know, that song absolutely knocked me over because the synths in that, synths became like available, you know. I mean, I remember seeing them in Frank Hesse's shop in Liverpool, and, you know, as soon as I saw one, I was like lusting. You know, this, and the good thing was I went in to play with it and they said to me, we have no idea what it does. Take it home, and then when you've found something out, bring it back to us and show us how it works. So I got a synth free to start with for a couple of months, and that's kind of how I learned to make little blips, and, you know, and it was just that on a synth you can create an atmosphere that you just cannot do with guitars. Guitars have caught up now with all the effects, but in the late 70s, early 80s, you know, the synths were expanding, growing. They were getting better all the time. And it was, like I say, the atmosphere they could create that really caught me. I'm not a pianist. In fact, if I play a piano, it hurts my fingers because it's heavy. Synth is really light. And, you know, it's more like a crazy toy, a synth, whereas a piano is a serious instrument. And the good thing with a synth is it's literally you make up your own sound, and you don't have to worry about chords, and you don't have to worry about music. It's just a noise-making machine, you know?
How did A Flock of Seagulls form?
I was in a band called Tuntrix, which later developed into a band called Hamby and the Dance, and they got a deal. But I was the bass player, and they went, your bass playing doesn't fit with this band. You're not a bad bass player, but, you know, I was playing Seagulls type of bass, and it didn't quite fit. So they actually said to me, go and start your own band, you know, and I was like, oh, yeah, what a great idea. So me and my brother got together. He'd never played drums, so he started playing drums. Like instantly, you put him in a kit, he just went, oh yeah, I can do this. He wanted to buy a big drum kit. So he bought this huge Tama drum kit. And after about 2 weeks, we took it off him. And we left him just with a kick drum and snare drum and a hi-hat, I think it's one cymbal. And then after he learned to play that, he didn't want the rest of the drums. So he sold those, and Simmons kits had just come out. And we were like, you know, we're like new modern synthesizers. And so he went and bought a Simmons kit. And I guess, you know, we call it like it's lucky ducks, you know, that ducks line up. And we were lucky to find the duck that lined up. And the Simmons kit fitted what we were doing exactly, you know, so became a Simmons kit drummer. And he said it was like beating bricks with sticks because they were rock hard and no give, but it suited the band. Synths came out, I bought a synth, we started the band and we called it, well, it had like 20 names. Then we kind of settled on Level 7, and as the band grew, then suddenly Level 42 came out, so we had to ditch that. And I was reading Jonathan Livingston Seagull and a couple of other things like Stranglers, and that whole Seagulls thing came to me, and we became a Flock of Seagulls, you know. So,
what was it like hearing your song on the radio?
There's two first times. The first time, we did some demos, and in Liverpool, they had like a show that was for local bands. And it was, you know, like local band hour. So we did this little demo. We took it to Radio City, who was the station that did it. And then we went back to our rehearsal room and we put local band hour on. And straight away, one of our songs was on. And this was like an hour after we'd given it to them. So they'd listened to it and went, wow, this is good, let's put it on. So we were all like dancing around, going, wow, you know, because some bands, they give it to them and it's weeks and weeks and weeks before they get it on. So that was the first most exciting, but of course we didn't have a record deal then. The next time was first time we came to America, we came to New York. And we got in a cab to go into the city, and it was on in the taxi. I think it was Talking was on, and we were just like, what? Wow, you know, turn it up, turn it up, turn it all the way up. So as we drove from the airport into New York, one of our songs was on, and that was like, we're 3,000 miles from home, and they're playing our stuff. It was, you know. And we're all high-fiving and giving it everything we've got.
What was the experience of having a hit single with Iran?
We'd had, like, you know, Telecom was a big dance club hit. It was like 18 weeks at number one in the dance club, but we weren't quite hitting the commercial charts. You know, we were bubbling under there. But when Iran took off, it was actually exciting. It was scary because, you know, every week you thought, well, it's up to number 30. Is it going to go up or is it going to drop? You know, so every Thursday or Friday when we got the news, it was like, oh my God, we're either bigger or we're nothing. And that went on, I think it was like 20 weeks of gradual climbing. When it hit the top 20, we were over the moon. And then it hit the top 10, you know, and we were just like, wow, what are we going to do now? How are we going to beat this, you know? But what happened was that we were on tour with some great bands. We ended up on tour with the Police, you know, playing huge places. So we'd gone from 200 size clubs to 50, 60, 70,000 size stadiums in 6 or 7 months. Most bands take a lifetime to do that. So to us, it was don't look back. Don't look down, don't look back, just keep looking ahead and just hope that everything keeps climbing. I would say it was more scary than exciting, actually.
Who came up with the concept for the Iran video?
We didn't know anything about video. So to tell you the truth, we were called into the record company. And they said to us, there's a new thing in America called MTV, and they're looking for promo clips from new bands. So you're going to make one. And we're like, how are we going to do that? They had a director there, and he said, you've got an hour to go buy some clothes, and then come back, and we're going to make a video. So we went out, we bought some clothes that we thought suited our style, came back, and they built this set out of wobbly mirrors, you might say. And they basically just said, go in there and, you know, pretend you're on stage and do this. And suddenly the iconic Iran video was born, you know. I think it took like 2 hours to make it. And the next day we sat down and watched it, and we all went, wow, is that us? It looks great. And the next day after that, it was on MTV. It was crazy times, you know, it was just snapped. I wouldn't say the band were trying to get on, but obviously the record company wanted us to make video clips and do videos for everything we wrote, because MTV were expanding, and it was in everybody's, you know, from Kansas to LA, from New York, in everybody's house, every cable company was carrying it. So it was really important. We didn't really know how important until we actually went on tour across America, and we played small towns, and the kids were like, we saw you on MTV, and you know, suddenly we were like, wow, we're huge on MTV and everybody knows us. So to us it suddenly became, without MTV we would probably play New York, Chicago, San Francisco, LA and go home. But it allowed us to come to America and play, I don't know, like 300 gigs in our first year or something. So it was a big thing for us.
Why do you think the 80s sound still resonates today?
In the 80s was like the last era where each band had an identity. It seems to me these days, not that I listen to a lot of new music, but it all tends to sound the same. Or bands tend to regurgitate the same thing over and over and over again. I think people look back on the 80s with like fond memories because they had their favorite bands and their favorite sounds. So as they've gotten older and their kids have grown up and gone away, or they've got their kids into what they listen to, you know, they've got more time to bring it back again and go, yeah, I remember I saw a Flock of Seagulls at you know, JFK Stadium or whatever it was, so I want to go see them again, I want to start listening to them. Same with say Simple Minds and Wang Chung and stuff like that. And I think that general feeling of let's have a good time again. And the 80s was a good time. Everyone was having a good time. I was having a good time, I'm sure. So I think that kind of brought that resurgence, you know.
Can you tell us about the hairdo?
I used to have like a Ziggy Stardust, spiked everywhere and long. And then quite early on, we all were trying to outfashion each other a little bit. And I was looking in the mirror trying to spike my hair up. And Frank Maudsley, the original bass player, he was like, oh, Scory, get down. You know, so he put his hand on my head and it just flattened it. But the sides were already up. In a small dressing room, there's usually mayhem, you know, of getting ready and it's time. So the manager was pushing us to go on. And I just went out with it like that. And it was down in my face and up at the sides. And I noticed that some people in the crowd were just pointing at it going, wow, look at his hair. So the next night, I did it like that. And after about a week of doing it like that, my manager goes, I think you've got something there. And he said, because everybody looks at it and talks about it. So it just kind of developed from there onwards.
Thanks for listening. Check out other episodes of Nostalgia Stories at WGNRadio.com/AntennaTV. Or for video versions of this podcast, go to YouTube.com/AntennaTV.